and will give an update on the latest developments in this direction in his talk tomorrow afternoon. So let me start broadly. Inflation is a beautiful solution to standard cosmological problems discovered by Paul and these others early on. And it's particularly good at diluting relics of high-scale physics. But one of the points of this talk, in addition to certain model-building results, is that inflation is nonetheless sensitive to high-scale physics in a very interesting way. Basically, because to get it to work, you need inflation to last, you need Hubble to change slowly enough for a long enough time to get the 68 foldings that are necessary. And that means from an effective field theory point of view, at a minimum, one needs to know the dimension 6 Planck suppressed operators in the effective theory. For example, in single field slow roll inflation, if you look at the eta parameter, which is a measure of the flatness of the potential and the length of inflation, you need it to be of order of percent. But if you look at a dimension 6 operator like this, which scales like the potential energy times phi squared over m Planck squared, that gives a correction of order 1, which would completely ruin inflation. So it's useful and, strictly speaking, necessary to formulate inflation in a UV-complete theory of gravity. And this is particularly true in the case, in the subset of inflationary models in which a tensor signature, in which gravity wave signature, is observable. And that's because of a fundamental and simple relation due to David Leith, showing that observable tensor modes corresponds to the scalar field inflaton executing a motion over a distance in field space, which is greater than the Planck scale during inflation. And I want to derive that for you very quickly, just because it is such an important relation. So this is, I think, well known here. In studying inflationary perturbations, we expand about an approximate De Sitter solution, looking at scalar perturbations and tensor perturbations of the metric and inflaton coupled system. And for example, in slow roll inflation, the calculation proceeds as follows. We're approximately in De Sitter space. We understand the mode solutions there. Expanding in creation and annihilation operators allows you to compute the two-point function very easily. It scales like Hubble squared, and similarly for the tensor modes. In the case of the scalar perturbations, there's another step to translate the scalar perturbation into the curvature perturbation, which is constant outside the horizon. This variable zeta, which entails an extra factor of Hubble over phi dot compared to the fluctuation of the inflaton phi itself. Anyway, putting all these things together, you get the scalar power, the curvature power spectrum, and the tensor power spectrum results given here. And the famous tensor to scalar ratio R then takes this form, phi dot squared over h squared in Planck units. So now we come to the Leith relationship, which is easy to derive as follows. Take the expression for the number of e-foldings during inflation. Integrate up dA over A, translate that into an integral over time times Hubble, and then translate that into an integral over field during inflation over phi. Well, that gives you this prefactor h over phi dot. Each of those factors is slowly varying during inflation, so you can pull it out of the integral. And you get, basically, from this integral then, delta phi over m Planck times this combination, which, if you remember my formula for r, just scales out as 1 over r to the 1/2. So the upshot is, whether you followed the algebra or not, that there's a simple relation between delta phi, the field excursion in Planck units, and the tensor to scalar ratio r, and the number of e-foldings. So if you put in the numbers, you basically find that for observable tensor to scalar ratio, by which I mean about 0.01 or greater that the CMB observers are saying they can get to, you find that you need a super Planckian excursion of the field. And so what that means is that we must ensure that the slow roll parameters are small during this range and field space, which is super Planckian, in any model with observable gravity waves. And what's so interesting about this, before we get into any specific mechanisms or models, is the fact that in a quantum theory of gravity, you would expect wiggles in the potential generically on this scale or below in field space. And so any such observation would give us, formally, in terms of Wilsonian effective field theory, an infinite amount of information about Planck suppressed operators in the theory. So let me just summarize the UV sensitivity of inflation. In general, the minimal UV sensitivity, whether or not you get to see gravity waves, comes from the sensitivity to dimension 6 operators in the slow roll parameters. If you see gravity waves, it means you evolved over a super Poincaré range of field, which is essentially infinitely UV sensitive. And finally, if you look at general single field inflationary models, they involve higher derivative terms, which affects things like the non-Gaussianity and so on. And so if we get to see non-Gaussianity, say, of the equilateral shape, then that is also very UV sensitive. So from a sort of low energy effective field theory point of view, it seems like this case with gravity waves with a super Poincaré range of field would be hard to realize. On the other hand, from a different point of view, in some ways it seems like the simplest possibility. It was an early model of inflation introduced by Linde in the 80s, in which he used an approximate shift symmetry along the inflaton direction, essentially to control the slow roll parameters, and said, you know, what's wrong with just m squared phi squared all the way out? And he formulated this model of so-called chaotic inflation based on that. So the new development is that we find a mechanism for essentially this, a mechanism for large field inflation from the top down, using a string theory model, using a phenomenon which I'll explain called monodromy. And the interesting thing is that we don't pop out, so although we control a large field range, we don't pop out, you know, m squared, phi squared, the sort of traditional model of chaotic inflation. Instead, there's an interesting twist. We pop out potentials like the one I've written here, phi to the 2/3, with distinctive signatures in a way that comes out very simply from the geometry. There's work in progress generalizing this basic idea to other classes of so-called string compactifications, which I'll also mention and which Alexander will discuss tomorrow. So why has it taken us so long to get to the point where we can make statements about, say, CMB data from string inflation, given that it is UV sensitive and well motivated? The reason is that inflation requires, well, that modeling inflation in string theory requires stabilizing all the many other scalar fields in the problem beyond the inflaton. And as is well known, there are many of these scalar field moduli in a typical background of string theory. Even after you make the choices necessary to get started, the choices of dimension, of topology, if the space is geometrical at all, and these famous electromagnetic fluxes and so on, you must do that in such a way to stabilize all the other scalar fields, because otherwise they have potentials that are too steep to inflate. And this has been gradually done in different corners of the theory, and has led, as a result, to interesting mechanisms for inflation already, some of which are predictive and have been discussed quite a bit in the recent literature. One of the things that happened recently is a new mechanism for moduli stabilization in a kind of more simple compact manifold, which led us to this new mechanism of inflation. And so I'm going to focus on that. This will not be a review of all of string inflation, but I just wanted to flash this slide to give you some sense of the development in general. So as I said, it's a kind of laborious process to do this because you have all these extra dimensions and scalars that describe the shape and size of the compact dimensions, which you must stabilize to even get started. Well, you might think if you're going to compactify extra dimensions, the simplest thing to do is to introduce periodic boundary conditions or so-called torus, and that's probably true. That's probably the simplest thing. And I would say the next simplest thing is the one we're going to use here called a twisted torus. So let me explain what that is. So again, a torus is just something with periodic boundary conditions in all directions. In the twisted torus, you have dimensions which are periodic. It's, say, two dimensions which are periodic with some identifications that I've drawn here, given by a translation in the, say, the x-axis and a translation in a complex tau direction. Now, as you move in a third direction in this twisted torus, the shape of the torus continuously changes. So this tau parameter goes continuously from what it started with to, you know, different taus and goes through tau plus 1 and tau plus n for different integers n. And if you look at this picture, you can see that if I make the identifications with 1 and tau, or 1 and tau plus 1, I get exactly the same manifold. It's the same set of identifications, just a different basis used to make the identifications. And so as I move in this third direction from tau to tau plus any integer, I'm dealing with a torus that's equivalent to the original one, and I can form a compact manifold by identifying them in the corresponding way. So the details of the compactification won't be too crucial. This is the place where we discover this monodromy mechanism, but I think it's worth getting a picture of it. So let me also just briefly summarize the mechanism we use to stabilize the moduli of that space before moving to inflation. So this space, as I said, had three directions, the two directions on this two-dimensional torus, and this third direction in which it changed shape. So we take a product of two of those to start from 10 dimensions and go down to 4, and include what's called an orientifold, one of these objects that violates the null energy condition in the extra dimensions, to get a consistent mechanism for moduli stabilization. And what one does is balance a bunch of different forces off of each other. So this manifold is curved. The torus changes shape as you move in the third direction. That introduces curvature, which gives, in 4 dimensions, a contribution to the potential energy, which is positive because the curvature is, scalar curvature is negative. And there are other of these famous brain-type objects and fluxes in string theory that also contribute to the leading order potential barrier in this system. Say, here I'm plotting the potential energy as a function of the string coupling strength in this system, or equivalently the inverse of the volume of the manifold. And you get a second and crucial negative term from these orientifolds that keep coming up with the negative tension, and then a third positive term from other types of fluxes. And altogether, you can put ingredients like this together and balance the forces to get a local de Sitter minimum to the potential energy. So the simplest version of this construction has basically three parameters in it and has a flux quantum number, F of order 100, put in to make it all work. One subtlety is that in the simplest version, the KK masses and the heaviest moduli masses are not parametrically separated in scale, though there's a more elaborate version which seems to push them apart if necessary. Anyway, the point I want to get to is this interesting mechanism for getting a large field range to do inflation. So I'm going to add one more ingredient to that stabilized compact manifold, which is a wrapped D-brain on one of the periodically identified cycles of the two-dimensional torus that I talked about. So if you remember what we said, there was a two-dimensional torus which changes shape as you move in a third direction. Now, if you wrap some object with tension along this direction, in a way that is consistent with the periodicity you're going to use to make a compact manifold, and then you move the whole set, say, to the right in this picture, again, consistently with the periodicity, the size of this circle that the thing is wrapped on increases in length. And so because you know the energy is tension times length, it becomes heavier. The potential energy increases in that direction. And if you think about it, even though this is a compact manifold, and this object is, as you move further and further to the right in this picture, it's moving around the manifold, it actually doesn't come back to itself. It comes back to itself up to a change in which cycle it's wrapped on in this two torus locally. This is called a monodromy, and what it means is as you move in this direction around this circle, the potential energy continues to increase, and the effective range of the field described by the collective coordinate of this object is kinematically actually infinite. This is a phenomenon which has been seen all over the place in gauge theory and in other types of string compactifications. If you're familiar with Seibert-Witten theory, it's the same as their monodromy, where you move around the moduli space and go from monopoles to dions, et cetera, et cetera. So one of the things we find very encouraging in this is that although we discovered it in this sort of simple compactification, kinematically, this effect is very, very common. So it's something that we can apply in many places. And I guess that's what I say here on this slide. And so let me just, for the purposes of this talk, continue with the case at hand to show you not just how it works kinematically, which is all we've seen so far, but what the dynamics is and how it manages to provide a model of inflation which satisfies the slow roll conditions and is consistent with the stabilization of moduli throughout this super Planckian evolution. And basically, because of this monodomy effect, those problems are easier than they first look in a way that the theory has just sort of popped out for us. Now, this phenomenon I mentioned of a geometrically unbounded field range is contrasts with a special case of what are called D3 ranges, point-like objects in the compact manifold, which people had focused on before. There, what happens is basically the field range is bounded by the volume of the space, and the Planck scale that you get in four dimensions is bounded by the size of the space as well. The question of how dilute gravity is in the extra dimensions determines the four-dimensional Newton constant. And so the field range in Planck units in a case with just point-like object is bounded by the same thing that bounds the four-dimensional Planck mass. However, in this other case, the Planck mass is fixed and the field range is unbounded, and that's the more generic situation. Now, there were earlier ideas which have some similarity to those I'm discussing involving wrapped brains or large number of brains, which happened to hit dynamical problems, back reaction and so on, at the next step. And but in our case, this four-brain, at its minimum of its potential, is parametrically lighter than the stuff we used to stabilize the moduli. So there's room to move it up its potential without destabilizing the whole setup. Now, using the geometry, basically, and what's called the DBI action, which describes the collective motion of the brain, you can derive the kinetic and potential energy terms in four dimensions that descend from this setup. And what pops out is a very interesting and surprisingly precise result for the inflaton potential in this theory. So the way it looks is what I've plotted here. At large values of the canonically normalized inflaton field phi, it scales like some coefficient times phi to the 2/3 power. And if you come back to the origin, the whole thing is analytic. It looks like m squared phi squared near the origin. But again, asymptotes at the relevant large field range values up to this phi to the 2/3 behavior. And what I've also plotted on here is the basic scale of the potential energy, the barriers that we use to stabilize the moduli in this compactification. And what happens when you plug in the numbers, given everything you know about the explicit moduli stabilization combined with this brain system, is that indeed the potential energy for this candidate inflaton can lie self-consistently below the scale of the moduli barriers, and hence the inflation sector is not going to destabilize the whole manifold. So, you know, we were very explicit about that in our paper on this subject, so let me just give you a flavor of it. One of the really interesting things that happens in this particular setup is that you could ask whether, because there was an m squared phi squared region of the potential, could you vary parameters to push that out to large values of the field range? And in this particular case, it fails. It cleanly fails. If you tried to do that, you would run up against the moduli potential, and you would destabilize the moduli. So here in this setup, m squared phi squared is excluded. But this phi to the 2/3 behavior, which, as I'll explain, is observationally distinctive from m squared phi squared, is so far viable. So then what you do is you take these three parameters I mentioned. You match, first of all, to the number of E foldings, and you match to the scale 10 to the minus 5 of delta rho over rho. And in terms of the parameters of this model, you find, for example, a flux quantum number of order 100 that you need to put in, this tau going to tau plus m turns out to be an m of order 1, and some anisotropy. Also, we need to put in a number of order a percent to get both the 10 to the minus 5 and the number of E foldings to work out properly. So this fits into the moduli stabilization parameters I mentioned earlier. So it's a good candidate, but it's very important in this game not to just declare victory by, you know, writing down some leading order potential that's likely to get corrected at order 1 in eta and epsilon. So we have to check all sorts of things. There's a long litany of systematic checks of alpha prime and loop corrections to the setup that we need to check. For example, if you, as I said before, if you correct eta at order 1, you ruin inflation. And if you correct it at the percent level, you don't ruin inflation, but you shuffle around your prediction for the tilt of the spectrum. So let's take a look at this. Well, basically because, well, okay, so you check, for example, in the 10-dimensional model, whether the monodromy, which is basically winding up this brain on the torus that I described, is introducing, you know, so many windings that it back reacts heavily in the geometry. And you can only assess this after putting in the relevant numbers that you need for the phenomenology. So once we did that, we find actually you need about 20 wrappings. It's not a large factor, and this is not the leading correction to the model. Similarly, corrections from the species living on these brains to, say, the Newton constant turns out to be a very small effect. The thing that leads as a correction is the fact that the inflaton potential depends not just on this collective coordinate inflaton phi, but also on the other moduli, of course, the size of the space, as well as the string interaction coupling and so on. And so the inflaton energy will push on the moduli, shift them around a little bit, and then in a way that depends on the inflaton, and so the moduli potential will push back and give you a slight shift in the shape of the potential energy. So you can estimate that very easily using the structure of the moduli potential that comes out in these simple perturbative stabilization mechanisms in string theory, where the canonically normalized field is related to the size L by an exponential. So basically derivatives with respect to moduli are just scaling the same as the potential barriers themselves. Anyway, putting that kind of thing in, you find that the corrections to the shape, or expressed in terms of the corrections to the eta parameter, are of order the original eta parameter, which was 0.01 as it needs to be, times the ratio of the inflation potential, which I'm calling V sub r, because it's induced by curvature, and the moduli potential, which we know is less than, this factor is less than 1. And so this is all consistent, and generically, when the inflaton energy is cleanly subdominant to the moduli potential, it'll even be a smaller correction than eta itself. Okay, now one of the most important developments in this subject of trying to do detailed inflationary model building in string theory was introduced in one of those three-brain models by Kachu et al, where they just emphasized the importance of the eta problem and how subtle it is and how sensitive it is to details of the compactification. And again, that's kind of a good thing because it means you have a lever to the UV. But in those examples, it means you kind of need to know where all the moduli stabilizing localized ingredients are before you conclude the, before you know the shape of the potential and the relevant range of fields that you're interested in. So there's a lot of important work in progress on that model and doing that, and it's very, very, developing very, very nicely. In our case, the issues are somewhat different in an interesting way because of basically of symmetry. So for one thing, we need to control it over this large range of fields, which sounds almost impossibly hard. But part of the point here is that because of this monodromy, you're executing these circles around essentially the same. So the main thing that breaks the translation symmetry around the circle is the inflation sector itself. And otherwise, as you move around this would-be circle, you're hitting the same elements. You're not running into new issues every string or Planck length in field space. And more precisely, what we use to control these slow roll parameters in this system is essentially a UV completion of Linde's original idea of having an approximate shift symmetry in the direction of motion. So in particular, in contrast to the three-brain case, the moduli stabilizing ingredients can be put in a way such that they're extended in the direction of motion of our brain. And that gives us the approximate shift symmetry that essentially Linde introduced as a way of controlling epsilon and eta. So here's a picture of that. I don't think we really have time to go into the details, but it's just what I said. There are a bunch of objects that are all extended in this direction. And so the symmetry prevents large corrections to the potential in a way that we can, in a way that we can understand as distinct from the issues involved in the three-brain case, where you have propagators going from the three brains to various localized ingredients that all contribute to eta, and which people then want to use to tune against each other to control eta in a small range of field. Here, we use a symmetry to get to cancel corrections over this long range in field. Now, we did a systematic analysis of the so-called alpha prime or stringy corrections and quantum or loop corrections. We don't claim a parametric limit in which we can get arbitrarily large field range, but we do claim that the necessary nine Planck units of field range we can comfortably obtain with, you know, in a controlled approximation scheme where the curvatures and couplings that we expand in are small. The standard model reheating are not yet explicitly included, and probably in this very simple compactification I presented, they might not fit. I mean, this is meant as a proof in principle that you can realize this mechanism of inflation, but it's not meant to be literally the real world. But there are some interesting points to make about that as well, which we may get to. But let me start with the important litany of corrections that one needs to assess to really conclude that the inflaton potential is reliable. First of all, curvature corrections to the action of our wrapped brain can be systematically included, assuming order one coefficients, that is not making any assumptions of extra small parameters in the setup. And one interesting thing that comes out of this when you then plug in the background leading curvature to the corrections that scale like curvature times the inverse tension of the string is that not only are the corrections small because the ambient curvature of the compactification is small, but actually they in themselves don't change the shape in these leading alpha prime corrections just because of the shape of this manifold, for what it's worth. And so we estimate all these corrections in a systematic way in the paper, so I won't belabor it here. And let me just come to the upshot, which is that it seems to work, and it has interesting observational predictions. So once we understand that we landed on this phi to the 2/3 potential reliably, we can just, you know, use the standard analysis of field theoretic inflation models to determine the predictions. And the tensor to scalar ratio ends up being of order 0.04 and the tilt of 0.98. That puts us in the plot we saw in the beautiful talk on W map earlier. That puts our model, depending on the number of U foldings, you know, in one of these circles indicated in green here on this plot, which is amusingly further inside, say, than m squared phi squared and phi to the 4th. And at least, you know, observationally distinguishable from them, at least by future data. And so it seems to be a very healthy time for you know, this general field because of the fact that the theory's getting better and the observations are looking very promising from, you know, what I understand. So as is well known, you get polarized signal in the CMB from scattering of CMB photons off of electrons, which are present during recombination and reionization. And in the presence of a gravity wave, that leads to this B mode signal. And it seems like the claim, anyway, of the CMB observer seems to be that you're going to get down to this scale we need of tensor scalar ratio of order a percent in, you know, the next 5 to 7 years, from what I'm told, by a large number. I don't think I even have all the acronyms listed here, but by a large number of independent ground and balloon-based experiments. So it just seems up to these, you know, seeming difficult foreground issues that they talk about, it just seems like a very promising situation where we'll be able to make these distinctions between different mechanisms of inflation. So also the Planck satellite, which is not supposed to do quite as well on R, will, as we heard earlier, do well on the non-Gaussianity and on the tilt. And so it seems, if, you know, if I'm understanding what's being said correctly, that on this plot, instead of this huge exclusion plot, which already is giving indication of the tilt, there will be some little thing, you know, of this size. And these different mechanisms will be distinguishable, which is, I think, in itself very exciting. So just let me back up again and just express my enthusiasm for the subject in general, on more general grounds, inflationary model building, particularly with the gravity wave and non-Gaussian signatures, is honestly UV sensitive. It's not a stretch to be trying to do that model building in string theory. You really have to do it in string theory to know what you're doing to have control over the inflationary model. And we find that when we do, when we get our hands dirty, interesting mechanisms and models pop out with distinct signatures. This at a time when the observations are getting going to get better and better. Now, as I mentioned, this phenomenon of monodromy that I explained, where there's a circle in the space of scalar fields up to that before you introduce the inflation sector, there's some circle, and then you add some extra ingredient, and you develop this monodromy where the potential energy is like this spiral that I described in the case of the twisted torus, is a much, much more general phenomenon. It's not really to do with a twisted torus per se. It happens all over the place in string compactifications. And so one of the obvious things to do, which we're doing, is check how it works out in other cases, like in Calabi-Yau compactifications, which can accommodate low energy supersymmetry. And Alexander will talk about this more tomorrow. Let me just advertise that by saying that in this case, we get a candidate example with a linear potential, not phi squared and not two-thirds, but linear, which puts us even more centrally in that famous plot. For what it's worth, it puts us, you know, somewhere in the middle here. And generally, we just like to more systematically assess, you know, what kinds of results, what kinds of shapes and potentials we can get from this mechanism more generally. And we'll just have to see how that comes out. And I, let me say one more thing about reheating. One thing you might worry is that when you do couple in the standard model, which you have to couple to at the end of inflation, so in our situation, you go on this by the two-thirds potential until you hit the m squared phi squared region, and then you know exit and oscillate down there. Reheating would proceed by coupling the inflaton sector to the standard model, and trying to excite the standard model degrees of freedom at the end of inflation down here. But since our inflaton goes around and around in some would-be circle in this moduli space, you hit those degrees of freedom, you know, periodically on the way. So you might wonder what effect that has. But one interesting thing to point out is that the during inflation, of course, since you're succeeding in inflating, you're rolling slowly. And the production of modes is determined by the field velocity. So it goes like field velocity to the 3 house power. And so as you're rolling slowly, you don't excite these particles. But as you exit and roll rapidly, you do. And it'll be interesting to see whether there are nonetheless some residual periodic effects of these sectors as perhaps residual signatures of this mechanism. Though this is, this is future work. I think I should probably basically conclude. What I've said is that there's a simple type of compactification out of which popped an amusing mechanism to get a large field range kinematically, and which admitted a controlled model of inflation with distinctive predictions. We're looking at the generalizations, hoping to get a systematic understanding of what kinds of models can come out of this general mechanism, and it's cleanly falsifiable on the basis of the tensor signal. So at least it's something for observers to perhaps aim to shoot down. Of course, reasonably explicit small field inflationary models have also been derived in string theory, like that brain anti-brain one I mentioned and one that Fernando is going to talk about later. So, you know, we don't have a sweeping prediction from string theory one way or the other on tensor modes. We'll hear from Lenny tomorrow or the next day on an interesting signature we could get from earlier physics of metastable eternal inflation if we don't obscure it by tensor mode. So there are all sorts of interesting possibilities either way. But the truth is we don't have a sweeping prediction of string theory one way or the other on the question of should we expect to see tensor modes in the CMB. What we do have is different mechanisms that are distinctive and predictive and distinguishable from each other by the data. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a great situation to be in. As I said earlier, it's the closest to instant gratification that I expected to get working on string theory. So it would be interesting to think more about what we might expect using more refined arguments about initial conditions and so on. But from the model building point of view, both of these interesting cases appear, and it'll just be great to find out which we land on in the real universe. So thank you.
I didn't quite get the intuitive picture. Is it the amount of twisting of the torus which is serving as the inflaton here, or?
No, it's the motion of a wrapped D4 brain. So there's the twisted torus by itself, which, you know, is a compact manifold of fixed Planck mass. So that, on that, you wrap this D4 brain. And as you move it around the nil manifold, this twisted torus, it gets heavier and heavier by this monodromy effect. So the inflaton is the motion mode of a brain.
Okay,
in the Calabi-Yau examples I mentioned, the inflaton is a closed string modulus, a would-be axion that's also subject to monodromy when you wrap brains on the corresponding cycle. So it could be either one.
So, but, and there's an infinite field range because every time it goes around, it's not really coming back to the same point.
Exactly,
is that
right.
It? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so you've made your case. There can be large field ranges. But there's another issue, and the other issue is that you would have to start at the beginning of inflation with a rather highly wrapped, in order to make use of it in an interesting way, you'd have to start with a configuration which was rather wrapped to begin with.
You do start wound up. It's like
yeah,
a wind-up.
You have to start wound up.
Yeah,
and no criticism.
No,
I just
want
to know if you thought at all about how you might get to that configuration and how you might think about the likelihood of getting
right.
To that.
Well, I think this is a great question. In fact, that's what I was mumbling about on this part of the slide. So let me say more. So let's assume that we came from some other vacuum and tunneled. The question would be. And you could even set this up in some compactification that could host both a small field model and a large field model like this, and ask yourself, starting from what you consider a generic, you know, previous vacuum, which are you going to land on? Now, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the sort of heuristic arguments would prefer the higher scale, longer range field, simply because there's less of an overshoot problem for the field. As compared to small field models, where there's some inflection point, you have to somehow land there. And the second reason is the patch that you need to inflate, starting from a higher scale, is you know needs to be smooth on it. The Hubble patch that you need doesn't to start, you know is smaller. The initial Hubble patch that you need to be smooth to get started is smaller. Now I don't know if those heuristic arguments would win. And I think maybe it would be useful to play concretely with this kind of question of starting from a different vacuum and trying to go in both ways. And there are, of course, mechanisms for slowing the field down and trying to land on a certain range of field. But again, that's more of a problem for small field models to begin with than it is for large field models. But I don't think any of us really understand the initial conditions for inflation, and I certainly don't. I think it's a great
question. I think we should move on to the next lecture. Thank you.